This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Astronomers have discovered the darkest known exoplanet, a distant Jupiter-sized gas giant known as TRESS-2b. Their measurements show that TRESS-2b reflects less than 1% of the sunlight falling on it, making it blacker than coal or any planet or moon in our solar system. And the most amazing thing about this discovery is that apparently you can find one too if you know where to look.
The search for transiting exoplanets is something that can be done essentially in your backyard.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, our astrobiology series takes us hundreds of light years away beyond our galaxy, right in our backyard. We'll also spend an academic minute finding out how we actually know what is orbiting distant stars. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Have you ever wondered what it would be like to discover an unknown planet? And what if you were able to observe that planet from millions of light years away in another galaxy, something called an exoplanet? Well, that's just another day at the office for Dr. David Spiegel. Dr. Spiegel is a postdoctoral member of the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton University. The Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gustina recently spoke with Dr. Spiegel about the discovery of the exoplanet TRESS-2b.
So the TRESS survey stands for Transiting Exoplanet Survey, perhaps. I could be mistaken about that. But it's a survey run out of the Center for Astrophysics at Harvard that was looking for transiting planets. So these are planets that have an orbit that's specially aligned so that once every orbit, the planet crosses the line of sight between Earth and the parent star.
Mm-hmm.
And that causes a slight periodic dimming in the light of the star. If Jupiter, for example, were to pass in front of the sun from the perspective of some other civilization, it would cause about a 1% dip in the light from the sun, which it requires sensitive observation to see a 1% dip, but not that sensitive. In fact, that would have been doable back in the 1950s if people had
really
been looking. So the TRESS survey looked for planets. It found this planet TRESS-2 a number of years ago, actually. And TRESS-2 was one of three planets known in the field of view of the Kepler Observatory prior to the start of the Kepler mission. Kepler is a telescope on a satellite that's staring at a single field of view on the sky that contains about 150,000 stars in it. And it's staring at these 150,000 stars for the mission of its lifetime, the lifetime of its mission, which is about 3.5 years nominally. It might end up being extended to 5 or perhaps even 10 years. But the goal of the Kepler mission, just to go on a little segue, is to find what's the frequency of Earth-like planets around sun-like stars. So the Earth obviously takes 1 year to go around the sun. So Kepler needed a lifetime of at least several years so that it could see several transits of an Earth-like planet around a sun-like star. And Kepler has been up for a few years now. Not all of the data is publicly available yet, but hopefully it will actually answer this question of what fraction of sun-like stars have Earth-like planets. And it's made tremendous strides towards actually answering this question so far. TRESS-2 was, again, one of three transiting planets known among these 150,000 stars before the start of the Kepler mission. And so it's one of the best observed transiting exoplanets. And transiting exoplanets present an opportunity for us to learn an awful lot about the planet. And the reason is we get two opportunities to learn about the planet's atmosphere. One is when the planet crosses in front of the star, we can learn something about the composition of the planet's atmosphere because some small fraction of the photons from the star end up passing through the planet's atmosphere and interacting with the planet's atmosphere. And at wavelengths or frequencies of light, colors of light, that correspond to strong atomic or molecular transitions. These are wavelengths or colors where the planet's atmosphere is particularly opaque. The planet actually appears somewhat bigger at those wavelengths because the atmosphere is opaque to the photons. And so it causes a bigger transit signal. You know, instead of 1%, it might be 1.03%. And at other wavelengths where there are not strong molecular features, the planet looks a little smaller. So we can learn about the composition of the planet during the transit. The other time when we can learn about the planet is when it half an orbit later, when it dips behind the star. And the reason that's really exciting is that immediately before the planet dips behind the star, we see it in this sort of full moon phase. fully illuminated by the star. We can't actually resolve this. It's just a single point of light from the star. But that light includes the light of both the star and the planet. Then once the planet goes behind the star, we get just the light of the star. And if we take the difference between those two, we get just the light of the planet. So this has been done for a number of planets in the infrared part of the spectrum where planets are somewhat brighter relative to their star. The Kepler mission is looking in the optical part of the spectrum, like normal visible light. And the ratio of brightness of the planet to the star is going to be lower in the optical than in the infrared. And so actually, there are very few planets where any optical light has been seen from the planet at all. Again, infrared light has been seen for a number of planets. For optical light, hardly any. TRESS-2, there were a tremendous number of observations of it since this planet was already known from the beginning of the mission. And my collaborator, David Kipping, at the CFA, Center for Astrophysics at Harvard, decided to take a look at all the observations of TRESS-2 and see if he could see the signal when the planet dipped behind the star. And it turned out he couldn't. The planet was so dim that he couldn't see any difference between when the planet was not behind the star and when the planet dipped behind. But then he had a really clever idea, which was not to use just the secondary eclipse, it's called, observation, not just immediately before and immediately after the planet dips behind, but rather to look at the entire orbit, where you get a lot more signal, way more photons, and you can make much more sensitive observations. And using the entire orbit, he was able to find a difference between the day side of the planet and the night side of the planet relative to the star of 6 parts per million. So in other words, when we're seeing the night side of the planet, it's 6 parts per million dimmer than when we see the day side of the planet, which is an incredibly dim signal to be able to detect. It's a more sensitive measurement than the Kepler mission was designed to be able to do. And so he contacted me and asked if I had any thoughts about what could be causing the planet to be so dim. And the only explanation that seems to make sense in the context of all the observations of this planet, TRESS-2, is that it has a fairly large amount of some optical absorber, something that absorbs optical light in the upper atmosphere. And that's what's causing it to be so non-reflective. But the name, the blackest world or the darkest world, is in a sense a bit of a misnomer. And there are two reasons. One is, it's actually not a super dark planet. Just because it's so close to its star, it's getting blasted with radiation, it's really hot. It's very non-reflective. It reflects something like 0.1% of the light that hits it. Coal, for contrast, reflects about 4% of the light that hits it. So it's about 1/40th as reflective as coal. But it's not dark because it's really hot. And so it's glowing the same way as the coils on an electric stove glow when they get hot. And in fact, it's glowing so brightly that if it were in our solar system, it would be about 3,000 times brighter than Venus, which is the brightest planet in our solar system from our perspective. In fact, it would be about the same brightness as the full moon. So it's not exactly dark. It's just very dark from our perspective relative to its star. The other reason why darkest is a bit of a misnomer is that there's actually some evidence that a lot of the hot Jupiters probably have this sort of mystery extra absorber in their upper atmosphere. And so probably a lot of them are actually comparably dark, comparably non-reflective to TRESS-2. And one of the big mysteries is, what is this extra compound that's absorbing optical light and making the planet so non-reflective?
Talking with Dr. David Spiegel, and what an interesting conversation we're having. And it's all about exoplanet climates. Now, you just mentioned a climate of TRESS-2, which seems pretty much uninhabitable. But of course, I never really thought about this, but in one of the abstracts of your articles, you say, according to the standard liquid water definition, the Earth is only partially habitable. So, you know, we deal with relative terms here, but certainly a planet that may be a glowing ember probably is not conducive to life. But do we really know all the different climates, let's say, planetary climates, where life can survive yet? I mean, are we still ferreting that out?
Absolutely. It's a great question. One thing that I think we need to keep our minds open about is that it's possible that there are all kinds of exotic forms of life that are very different from anything that we've seen on Earth, and very different from anything that Earth-based biochemists and origin of life researchers and so on have even conceived of. In fact, there might be kinds of life that alter the chemistry of their planet's atmospheres in ways that are so different from the ways that we've thought of that we wouldn't even be able to recognize this sort of life if it were to be there on a planet, even assuming 20 or 30 years from now that we have the kind of very advanced observatory that could detect Earth-like life on an exoplanet. There could be other kinds of life that we just wouldn't know how to recognize.
I mean, after all, Dr. Spiegel, we are still discovering life on this planet, aren't we? In some of the deepest oceans and some of the places where we haven't been able to get to before.
That's right. Some of the places that seem fairly uninhabitable from our standards.
Sure.
Places here on Earth are found to be teeming with life. In fact, there's life living deep inside of rocks, kilometers into rocks. There's life at the South Pole, where the living organisms can reproduce at temperatures of 20 below zero Celsius. That's temperatures at which liquid water is frozen, but some of these forms of life can melt very small little pockets of water around where they are and reproduce extremely slowly. They can survive down to temperatures of 85 below zero Celsius.
And these deep sea explorations we see where there are organisms living on the sea floor with virtually no light.
Absolutely. Yeah, there are organisms on the sea floor that get hardly any sunlight, again, inside of rock that get absolutely no sunlight. And there are creatures living near hydrothermal vents, where the temperatures get to be 130 degrees Celsius, so above the boiling point of water. There's some organisms. There's one called Strain 121 that was found off Puget Sound in Seattle. It's a strain of archaea, similar to a bacterium, that reproduces at 121 degrees Celsius, hence the name Strain 121. And it can actually remain living up to temperatures above 130 degrees Celsius. I think it's kind of interesting about these temperatures, besides simply that it's above the boiling point of water, is that the autoclaves that are used to sterilize biomedical equipment.
Sorry, what are autoclaves?
These are essentially ovens that cook scalpels and other things that are used in hospitals to sterilize them. These autoclaves themselves get up to temperatures of about 120 degrees Celsius. So they actually would not kill Strain 121 if it happened to be on the instruments in hospitals. Luckily, Strain 121 doesn't seem to have found its way into hospitals. It seems to like being in hydrothermal vents. But the point is that there are these so-called extremophiles, these creatures that like really extreme conditions from our perspective, that exist even right here on Earth. And we could certainly imagine that on planets around other stars that have very different conditions from here on Earth, there might be creatures that like other kinds of extreme conditions and have other sorts of influences on the chemical nature of the planet's atmosphere than what we've considered so far. So there could be hidden pockets of life that we would not know how to recognize.
Still to come, David Gostina's conversation with Dr. David Spiegel continues with a look at what to look for when looking for life on other planets. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a tape or CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1125. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today in our astrobiology series is Dr. David Spiegel, a postdoctoral member at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton University. He spoke with The Best of Our Knowledge's David Gostina about his discovery of the exoplanet TRES-2b. The conversation continues as Dr. Spiegel talks about what to look for when looking for life.
I think it makes sense as we think about the search for life around other stars, or even around our sun on other planets. It makes sense to start off by looking for the kinds of life that we're familiar with. We know that the life on Earth seems to really like water. And so looking for planets that have a significant amount of water seems like a good starting point. We know that the life on Earth, some of it, produces molecular oxygen. So looking for evidence of molecular oxygen in the atmospheres of other planets might also be a sensible thing to do. But stepping back, one of the more basic things that life does on Earth is it creates disequilibrium in the chemistry of the atmosphere. But there are other things that can also create disequilibrium in the atmosphere of a planet. So I think as we start to take a broader look on what sorts of forms exobiology could take and whether we could robustly identify an exobiological system, a biological system around another star, as we think about what sorts of forms an exobiological system could take, one of the really important things to think about is how can we tell the difference between the sort of disequilibrium that life can cause from the sorts of disequilibrium that non-biological systems can create, so that we could robustly identify if we see a certain kind of disequilibrium that had to be caused by biology as opposed to some other non-equilibrium chemical process.
It seems like these processes that you scientists are engaged in are more and more sophisticated every single year. And I'm wondering if you might spend a moment on the sophistication involved in what you do and marry that to the technology, because what we've seen in our lifetimes as a result of this technology, despite the fact that you've already said, Dr. Spiegel, that some of these experiments could have been done back in the 50s, we certainly have, forgive the pun, jumped light years in the last few decades in terms of what we're able to observe, at least.
Absolutely. So technology has allowed for a variety of improvements in our ability to learn about planets around other stars. And the technology development has helped both the observational searches and the theoretical interpretative work. On the observational side, people are getting really good at building large telescopes. The expense involved in building large telescopes is still extreme, but it's less extreme than it used to be. And so there are bigger telescopes than there used to be in the past, you know, over 30 feet in diameter. There are telescopes in space that can observe at infrared wavelengths that are inaccessible on the ground because our atmosphere is partially opaque to infrared light. But if we send satellites up into space, they can look at wavelengths that we can't look at from the ground. They're also not subject to the sort of twinkling effects. If you look at the night sky and you see stars twinkling, that same sort of thing makes it difficult to conduct very precise measurements of a star's brightness from the ground. It's much easier from space because the twinkling is caused by the Earth's atmosphere. So there have been a whole variety of advances on the observational side. Another thing is so-called CCD detectors, which are like the kind of detector that's inside your digital camera. These have been available for a few decades, but they've become a lot less expensive, a lot more sensitive, a lot more pixels can be squeezed onto them than in the past. The kinds of detectors that are inside a standard digital camera, cell phone camera today, are more advanced than any detectors that were around 30 years ago. Now, back then, people were using photographic plates, sort of like film. And it's just much more difficult to do the kinds of sensitive observations that are needed on film. On the theoretical side, advances in computing have revolutionized the kinds of studies that are possible now.
Is this because we are using a lot of math equations in all of this?
That's right. We're trying to model physical processes having to do with the motion of fluids in a planet's atmosphere. By fluids, I mean the gas and potentially the liquids that might be on the surface.
Right.
So there are a set of equations called the hydrodynamics equations that are very complicated mathematical equations to solve. We can write them down with not too much problem, but actually solving them is a very difficult problem. And for a long period of time, people have come up with approximate ways of solving them, solving simpler sets of equations. So this has been done in Earth climate studies for decades. But we've now reached the stage where we can actually solve some of the equations that are the ones we're really interested in. We don't have to make these approximations. There's also equations having to do with the interaction of radiation with matter. So by radiation, I just mean light, visible light or infrared light. As it passes through a planet's atmosphere, some of the light, some of the photons pass straight through. Others interact with molecules in the atmosphere. They can heat the molecules. This heating of the molecules can block some of the photons. Figuring out what the spectrum of light will look like when you have a planet that has radiation passing through the atmosphere and you look at this planet from many light years away like we are, that's the sort of observation that I want to simulate. This sort of simulation is possible now. It wasn't really possible 20 or 30 years ago.
And what about finding planets, right? The internet. There are amateur astronomers out there that are scouring the skies.
That's right. The search for transiting exoplanets is something that can be done essentially in your backyard using very small telescopes. Some of the most sophisticated ground-based searches for transiting exoplanets essentially use fancy digital cameras.
Which speaks to this issue of the newer cameras and the technology and the proliferation of these home-use telescopes that people can pick up.
Absolutely. Also, Kepler has collected a lot of data on these 150,000 stars that it's observing, and some of this data is publicly available. Anyone can download it and track any of these stars. Presumably, the Kepler team has very smart algorithms to search through the data and has found most of the planets that are lurking in the data before they make the data public. But they might not have found all of them. And in fact, there was a so-called crowdsourced planet discovered in the Kepler data by a team of amateurs working in collaboration with some professional astronomers.
Fantastic. Well, this is the kind of collaboration that I imagine may have its positive and negatives, but I would imagine the scientific community is pleased.
Absolutely. The scientific community is excited for two obvious reasons. One is that it makes our job easier because it gets some work done. And the other is it's a great way for anyone to really see what science involves, to actually to realize that anyone can do science. It's not something that can be done only by people in the ivory tower or whatever. Looking at data, trying to interpret what the information about the universe actually tells us about the universe is a field of study that anyone can do.
Dr. David Spiegel is a postdoctoral member at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton University. He spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter, David Gustina. Our coverage is made possible by the NASA Astrobiology Institute through support from the New York Center for Astrobiology, located at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, in partnership with the University of Albany, the University of Arizona, and Syracuse University. You can find more information online at origins.rpi.edu.
Spaceman, won't you please take me along? I won't do anything wrong. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride?
Detecting and identifying objects orbiting faraway stars takes a whole process. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. It seems that discoveries of planets and other objects beyond our solar systems are increasing at a steady pace. Alice Quillen, associate professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Rochester, reveals the technique used to detect one of the more unusual objects to have been discovered.
In the past few years, hundreds of extrasolar planets have been discovered by searching for transits. A transit happens when a celestial body blocks or eclipses the light from a star. But a transit isn't always just a planet passing in front of a star. A planet could be part of a large ring system that is orbiting and eclipsing the star. A young star could be surrounded by a gas disk. Or a gas disk could be orbiting a star that is a member of a binary system. Because planets are small, they block less than 1% of the light from a star. But in the case of a ring system or a disk, both are much larger than a planet, the star could disappear completely during the eclipse. Instead of lasting for just a few hours, like a transit of the Sun by Venus or Mercury, an eclipse by a disk could last weeks or months. These are clues that let us figure out what is passing in front of a star many light years away from Earth. We searched hundreds of young stars in an archive containing millions of light curves. These are graphs of brightness as a function of time. We found a 30-day long and deep eclipse in the brightness of a young solar-type star that took place in 2007. In the deepest part of the eclipse, more than 90% of the starlight was missing. We suspect a dusty ring system orbiting a smaller body, such as a planet or a low-mass star, caused this eclipse. There are two other star systems that show eclipses by disks, and both are visible with the naked eye. By searching for dips in the brightness of more stars, we should discover more eclipsing disk or ring systems.
That was Alice Quillen of the University of Rochester. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.